KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're a bookseller, there's always some bad news to go with the good news. Industry insiders are said to be worried about long-form, non-fiction crime stories, for example. Apparently, the rise of podcasts like Serial have cut into that market. But science fiction is going gangbusters. Observers say it has something to do with the crazy big popularity of the new Star Wars series. E-books are still something local bookstores have to compete against, but their popularity seems to be stagnant right now. More than a half billion books, paper books, were sold last year, and that number is up from the year before by 17 million. And that's not too shabby. Today in the program, it's our annual Vacation Book Show. Our local experts are back with us with dozens of titles for you to consider for your summer reading. So join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer vacation book show where we invite our usual suspects into the studio to give you some titles to consider as you head off to relax and recreate. At the end of these shows, when we reflect back on them, we often say the same things to ourselves. I wish we had more time to get to this, or wish we had gotten to that. And so our producers, Ben and Elaine, always urge me to get to the books and keep the chatting to a minimum. And I'm going to follow that advice today, mostly, for the most part. I probably won't. But let me reintroduce our panel of book experts so we can jump right in. Ken Sanders back with us, founder of Ken Sanders Rare Books. Welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Betsy Burton back with us, co-owner of King's English Bookshop. Welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
And Kat Weller is the new book buyer for Weller Book Works. Welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay, so I just want to remind listeners also before we do jump in that you don't have to worry if you didn't get a title written down in time. We have a list of all of the books that we talked about today, we'll talk about today on our website, radiowest.org, even the titles we didn't get to, and we never get to them all quite. All right, I won't chat too much, but what's big? What are you guys noticing? I always wonder about in the summer before an election year if people are thinking about that or trying to escape all of that.
No, they are thinking and they are reading. I think they're wanting to escape, and what better escape is there than books?
Yeah.
Everybody needs to escape. Actually, the book business is just thriving. It couldn't be better. It's better than at any time in my memory since the 80s. It's wonderful.
It's a great season. This has been a fantastic set of lists. Some of the houses have had just author after author with books that are seemingly so perfect. This is a great season for books.
Better
than the holidays.
Yeah.
Really. And you guys, you guys were raving about that, too, so that's saying something.
It's fantastic.
Doug, I'm striving and succeeding at keeping my bookstore completely and utterly free of contemporary political books related to this election. I'm particularly proud of my record of being the bookstore that's 100% Trump-free.
I think we are, too, actually.
Okay, well, Ken Sanders, why don't you jump in and get us started here?
All right, Doug. First, I have a confession to make. I like to read junk mysteries, and I read history. I read interesting things that come in the store. But this new book, and I'm not real good at new book, and I'm really weak on history, this one just intrigued me. It's called Ivory Vikings, The Mystery of the Most Famous Chessmen in the World and the Woman Who Made Them. Now, how you can't take a book like that home and read it, I don't know. So I learned a lot, so I'm going to give you, sort of a straightforward book report. Margaret the Adroit of Iceland, how's that for a cool title, in the 12th century carved this 92-piece chess set. I never knew this before.
Wait, this is true?
Mm. Yeah, this isn't fiction. I'm not making, I know I make things up, Doug. I'm not making this up.
Okay, good.
The author might be, but not Nancy Marie Brown. The author might be making it up. No, she's not. And neither am I. 92 pieces. Harry Potter played with these chessmen, played wizard's chess with them. So they're famous, but just I'm ignorant of them. It's just the whole concept of the book is absolutely brilliant, and I just love it that there's so much history out there that ignorant people like me know absolutely nothing about. And it's a really a joyous way to learn part of our world history, which I think is very, very important.
Great. Say the name again.
Ivory Vikings by Nancy Marie Brown. I want to spend a minute or two with one of my favorite authors, Jim Harrison, who we've lost in the past year. Yeah. He was a good friend of our friend Doug Peacock and also the late Charles Bowden. These two books, Dead Man's Float, the last collected volume of his poetry, and The Ancient Minstrel, his last novel, that's going to be the legacy that Jim Harrison left us. And from The Legends of the Fall throughout his whole career, brilliant, contentious, angry writer, if you will. And I have to say it, I think his strength as a writer is novellas and poetry.
Yeah.
I think he's one of the finest poets we've ever had.
People don't think of him as a poet sometimes, but his poetry's unbelievable.
That's what his roots are.
Yep.
And there's some doggone fine poems in Dead Man's Float and his latest novel, The Ancient Minstrel. So two new ones, the last I assume we'll ever see. Hopefully they won't pull a Harper Lee on him when he's gone. And lastly, when was the last time we heard from Annie Dillard, for crying out loud? The Abundance, it's a new book, but it's a collection of essays, both old and new.
Right.
So it is a new book.
Is there new stuff in there?
There is new stuff, or recent stuff in it, but a lot of older material.
Yeah.
I don't know the story behind her decade-plus-long silence. I think it would be an interesting one. She certainly, from her first volume of poetry, Teaching a Stone to Speak, to her legendary natural history books, it's a curious long absence. And I for one, am glad to see even a quasi-new book out from the legendary author of Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
Say the name again.
The Abundance, Narrative Essays, Old and New, Annie Dillard.
Great. Ken, thanks. Kat?
Okay, my first book is from Don DeLillo, who has written so many novels over time. White Noise, Underworld, High Rise, which is a film that is of great frustration to people right now because they can't see it anywhere except on the coasts. His new book is called Zero K, and I have to say this is his best novel in years. Uh-huh. This is the DeLillo that a lot of people knew and loved back in the day. He's circled back with the story of a young man who goes to a place called the Convergence, which is somewhere in the stands, somewhere around Uzbekistan, somewhere in the stands over there, off the map, where there is a cryogenic laboratory and a sort of think tank that's set up for people. He is there to attend his stepmother and his father at the death of his stepmother and then watch as she is cryogenically preserved to be reanimated at a later, more wonderful time, of course. At the beginning of the book, I thought he was a young man, but really he's about in his 30s. And he spends time wandering through this facility where things are very nondescript, nameless places, nameless things, lots of doors. And there's this fantastic passage at the beginning where he's wandering through, knocking on doors to see if anybody's really behind him. He knocks on one, no answer, goes to another, no answer, keeps going, hits the sixth door, and he knocks on it. And a man in a turban answers, and he just looks at him very coldly. And the character says, "I must have the wrong door." And the man in the turban replies, "They're all the wrong door." It's just this peculiarly cold, abstracted environment in which he finds himself for something that grows increasingly fraught. And the end, what his father, who is invested in this company and is solidly behind it, what his father decides in respect to his stepmother's death, it was a bit shocking to me. And it's a bit moving, too. It's actually a really good book. And strong in all the fantastic DeLillo lays. So it's Zero K by Don DeLillo.
Great.
The next one is a romp. It's just an absolute romp from a press called Melville House, whom I adore. Young people doing interesting and different things. The book is called The Insides by Jeremy Bushnell. He wrote The Weirdness a couple of years ago, another romp. And there's a line in here, getting what you want always has consequences. And one goes through that through this book over and over again. Ollie Krueger is a woman who learned magic as a street magician. Now she is a butcher in a very high-end hipster restaurant in Manhattan called Carnage. She comes into possession of a magic knife that everybody wants. All of the bad people want the magic knife. She's chased by an ex-Marine named Pig, who represents white supremacists, a psychic Scandinavian for hire who is tracking her, and it's just all over Manhattan, in other dimensions. But this is not so much world-driven like fantasy usually is. It's character-driven. So keep that in mind with these, and ultimately it's about people coming to terms with their histories. But it's a romp. It's funny. It's satirical. It's ironic. So it's wonderful. It's called The Insides by Jeremy Bushnell. The last one is a book by Alain de Botton. He's returned to fiction with his book, The Course of Love. And this is a book about love in not the intense new way, but what happens after you've been together. You've had your kids, you're at home with the children, and you've found them profoundly boring, but love them more than anything. And you betray each other, and your life bores you, and how do you go on? And again, this is a character-driven book, not a plot-driven book at all. But the way he brings these people together and draws attention to their lives, the minutiae of them, and the minutiae of the people themselves is just lovely. I almost think Jane Austen readers would like it.
Wow.
Because it focuses on manners, relationships. So, Alain de Botton.
You've heard him on this show, by the way.
Love.
He's a terrific philosopher.
Religion for Atheists, How Proust Can Change Your Life.
Perfect. Kat, thanks. Betsy Burton.
Okay, so I'm going to present one book right now, and if I had to pick a great read for the summer, this is it. It's Everybody's Fool by Richard Russo. Mm. He did do a book about 20 years ago involving the same characters called Nobody's Fool that was made into a movie people might remember with Paul Newman. You don't have to have read that to read this. And actually, much as I love that, this is better. It's hysterically funny. And just to give you an idea of the characters, the chief of police has been forced into giving a benediction. And he's standing at a graveside ready to give the benediction. And in his pocket, he has something that is very dear to him and is also torturing him. It's a garage door opener, because his wife, who is deceased, was having an affair, and the only clue to who the affair might be with is this garage door opener. So he's been driving around town. So he's standing there, and I'm not going to tell you how this happens, but the garage door opener disappears, and the only place he can later figure out it might be is in the grave. I won't tell you why, but that is the case. And so he has these friends, and Richard Russo is a chronicler of small towns. All of his books are set in upstate New York, and he just gets the rural character, well, the character of anybody really, but the rural character perfectly. And one of the main characters is Sully, who was the main character in Nobody's Fool, and he was an odd jobs man. Now he's come into money, but he's just a good guy. He's having an affair, or was having an affair, with the woman who owns the town's cafe. So the book involves her and her daughter and the daughter's abusing husband, but there's also this real estate developer, Carl, who's just kind of the quintessential bad guy. So one night, the chief of police, Raymer, and Sully and Carl decide that they're going to find out if this garage door opener is in the grave. And so there's a reading, and you're about to hear what happens next.
Sully was studying Raymer, whose whole demeanor had changed since they'd arrived at Hilldale. Having set these proceedings in motion, He now looked like a man who finally understood their gravity. He was staring at the grave they were about to desecrate, but his gaze, unless Sully was mistaken, was inward. "Hey?" Sully said, swinging the backhoe's claw into position. "What?" Raymer said, snapping out of it. Testing the levers that lifted and lowered the inverted scoop, Sully said, "You sure about this? Because what we're about to do here is..." "Criminal," Carl suggested, returning from the truck. "Deviant? Perverse? Imbecilic?" Sully ignored this. "If we get caught," he told Raymer, "it's your reputation on the line." "What about mine?" Carl said. "That's hilarious," Sully told him. Raymer glanced around nervously. "Who's going to catch us?" "We won't know until they show up." Raymer worked his jaw as if he was literally chewing on the problem, then finally stiffened into resolve. "All right, what the hell?" he said. A few minutes later, the backhoe's steel teeth located Judge Barton Flatt's casket with a fingernails on the blackboard screech. All three men winced. "Relax, Your Honor," Sully called down into the hole. "It's just me, not God."
That's a very typical quote from this wonderful book. And he will be at the bookstore tonight, and we are thrilled to have him, I'll tell you.
Richard Russo. Okay. He's at the bookstore tonight.
Yeah, oh. Yeah.
Everybody's Fool. That was a reading by the actor Mark Bramhall, by the way. Betsy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Catherine, back to you.
All right. So now I have a nonfiction smorgasbord here.
I'm seeing the gene.
Yep. You all talked with Siddhartha Mukherjee week before last.
Yeah.
This is The Gene in Intimate History, which I just can't rave enough about. You know, there is really good science writers who write for the popular market have a sense of poetry and language that makes their books transcend, not the topic, but transcend the images people have of the topic. Yep. And Mukherjee has that.
I think you have to do a book about poetry.
Well, in a way you do.
Right?
Because
it's super complicated.
It's very complicated. And one of the wonderful things about this is that he, as with The Emperor of All Maladies, has this sweeping sort of view of his topic. He goes from Mendel and the peas up to epigenetics, but he does get into the weeds with there. You know, you got to take your waders to get through some of those later chapters, but he does it with such a sense of style and grace. He brings in his own family genetics with the most likely heritable mental illness that his family has seen in generations. It's just a lovely and brilliant popular science book, complete with glossary, notes, fabulous index. I wrote an index once. I know how hard that is. And puns. So if you're interested in finding what that core kernel of our identity is, and everybody's talking about genetics these days, right? We're still having the nature versus nurture debate. And he tackles this some in here, not to people's satisfaction, but that's an ongoing debate. This book is roughly organized by themes. So you start with the old stuff, Darwin and Mendel. You go up to the new stuff. And it will take a while to get through, but you will have loved it when you've done it.
Yeah.
So, The Gene by Siddhartha Mukherjee. The next, this is a movie tie-in cover they sent me, and I hate it. But this book is fantastic.
Really is.
Ken referenced a Harper Lee moment. And, you know, the thing about the Harper Lee moment is it allowed us all to understand what editors do. This book, Max Perkins, Editor of Genius, which is about to become a movie, was one of my father-in-law's favorite books. He bought out the end of the print run, and I never would have known about it had he not thrust it in my hands when I started working at the bookstore and said, if you want to know about the book business, read this book.
Huh.
Maxwell Perkins was the man who edited Fitzgerald, who edited Hemingway, who edited Dreiser. He helped these men shape their writing and become magnificent writers. It harkens back to the day of when editors really edited books and worked with writers in a supportive full relationship, not just a partial relationship.
Kat, he made Thomas Wolfe.
He made Thomas Wolfe. And ooh, I'm sorry, that's a big part of this book, is his relationship with Thomas Wolfe. I guess it's a big part of the movie. It is a fantastic book for learning about the good old days of literature and what an editor does and what writers did. All those classics we were beat over the head with, this book gets you into them in a readable, lively way. It's fantastic. Max Perkins, Editor of Genius by A. Scott Berg, noted biographer.
Yeah.
Last and very quickly, this is a book about the other F word, feminist. It's by Andy Zeisler, the former editor of Bitch Magazine. It's called We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of a Political Movement. It's about how it's really trendy to be a feminist, but we still haven't dealt with the core issues yet.
Say the name again.
We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of a Political Movement by Andy Zeisler.
What's she like? Would she be good on the show?
She would be very good on the show. She's been in the trenches for years. She is a pop culture maven, so she pulls everything in from Beyonce to issues of pay equity.
Yeah.
And she does them all with great knowledge and
it's kind of sassy.
Adroit. Yeah. She's very sassy. Yeah. Bitch Magazine was sassy.
It totally. Kat, great. Thank you very much. Okay, Betsy, back to you.
Okay, I'm going to continue with some more fiction. One of my very favorite books of the summer and probably of the year is La Rose by Louise Erdrich, who I think of as one of the best writers that our country has. She's been painting this territory and the land where the Ojibwe and the whites converge for many years with many novels. And this is one of the best, and they're all brilliant. It involves a young boy whose father has accidentally killed his best friend Danny and cousin. And so in an act of atonement, La Rose's family gives La Rose to Danny's family, Dusty's family. But, of course, this doesn't fit well with the mothers in the family. And there's all of this tension. And there is deep unhappiness in the family of Dusty, revolving around the sister. So La Rose is trying to heal everybody. And then we go back in time, several generations, to another La Rose, a girl who was given away by her mother to a trapper, a white trapper, is abused, escapes, and the La Roses successively come down through the generations to the La Rose of the present. It's brilliant, and it gets you by the throat. It makes you so sad, and yet she's got great compassion. It's just an incredible, incredible book.
Say the title.
The La Rose, and it's Louise Erdrich.
Yeah.
Two great books that involve the war, Our Summer Before the War by Helen Simonson, and Everyone Brave is Forgiven by Chris Cleave. In the first book, it has a very Jane Austen-ish tone. It's a young girl who wants to become a teacher. She's been an amanuensis for her father, but he left her money in the control of trustees who don't have her best interests at heart. So she's taken under the wing of a grand dame in Rye, East Essex. And there's all this these village politics. There are two cousins who she might or might not fall in love with. And you think, oh, how Jane Austen-ish and delightful. But there's a Romani camp nearby, and then they're flooded with refugees as Hitler invades Belgium. And so there's this whole underbelly of this high society, easygoing English, you know, comedy of manners on the one hand, and on the other hand, these terrible problems that we're again facing today. And it's a brilliant read, and it's just an interesting book. The other one, quickly, Everyone Brave is Forgiven by Chris Cleave. Another woman, she wants to be an ambulance driver but becomes a teacher. The Blitz is happening. All the kids are evacuated. She has a room with 13 kids. And she falls in love with the schoolmaster, then falls in love with his best friend. So there's this triangle. There is the invasion of Malta. There's all of this melodrama, but he's a wonderful writer, so you can't put it down. It's a great, great read. And these two pieces, different looks at World War II taken together. I read them back to back. Were absolutely fascinating. This last one is Everyone Brave is Forgiven by Chris Cleave.
Great. Mr. Sanders.
Well, Doug.
Are you related to Bernie Sanders?
Pardon?
Are you related to Bernie Sanders?
Yeah. Can you feel the burn?
Are you?
No.
Who knows?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not that he knows.
I've been reading, and I have to confess, I haven't quite finished it yet, because compared to a lot of the mysteries I like to gobble up in an evening, The Mirror Thief by Martin Say is a 600-page-plus opus, a first novel by an American. It's really quite brilliant. I'm not sure I quite understand all the metaphors in the book, however. The heart of the book is about the 17th century guild of glassmakers and mirror makers and the secrets and the Council of the Ten and all this mysterious underworld that existed back then, kind of the dark side of the Enlightenment, if you will. And the book begins in a Venetian casino in Las Vegas, and then it segues to Venice, California. And then the heart of the book is 17th century Venice, wow. 16th and 17th century Venice. And
the Italian version, of course.
Yes, the real Venice.
The real version.
As it were, not the Vegas or the canal, silly canal, California version. And then it goes back through Las Vegas, the Venetian, and Venice Beach, California again, and then segues in the final segment that I haven't quite read yet, so I haven't put the whole book together yet, but I'm interested enough in it that I'm going to finish the last 200 pages back to the real Venice again. And I realize that's completely confounding and confusing and doesn't explain anything, so in absence of finding him reading the book online, I'm going to read you a piece that will more thoroughly confuse you. Okay?
Go for it.
You made Cravano up, right? Wells sighs, looks out at the ocean. With Cravano, he says, I took a number of liberties. In the historical record, he is barely a shade. I filled in the gaps as imaginatively as possible. Of course, it is precisely those lacunae that made it possible for me to write the book at all. You're telling me Cravano was a real person, Stanley says. He was a historical person, yes. I discovered a brief and rather cryptic mention of him in the letters of Surer Giustina Glicenti while I was researching an entirely unrelated matter, and I was enchanted by the metaphoric possibilities he suggested. You're pulling my goddamn leg. I am not, no. From Sir Giustini's account, I was able to infer only that the Council of Ten issued an arrest order for a person named Vettor Cravano in the summer of 1592, accusing him of taking part in a conspiracy to steal from the craftsmen of Murano on behalf of unknown foreign entities information regarding the manufacture of flat glass mirrors. In those days, a person so accused could expect to be imprisoned or enslaved, or if he somehow managed to escape the city, to be pursued by assassins and murdered. It was a very serious matter. The Murinese greatly benefited from their virtual monopoly on the flat glass mirrors well into the 18th century. So we can assume that Cravano was unsuccessful. From other sources, I discovered that he was a physician and an alchemist who took his doctorate at Bologna, and I was able to trace his family origins to colonial Cyprus prior to the Ottoman siege. The remainder of his biography, I, to borrow your phraseology, made up.
The Mirror Thief.
By Martin Say, first novel.
Oh, good. Okay, Ken Sanders, thank you very much. Founder of Ken Sanders Rare Books, of course. Betsy Burton with us, co-owner of the King's English Bookshop. Catherine Weller is the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. And as I mentioned, we have a list of all of these titles on our website if we don't get to some. If you want to go back and look at those titles, radiowest.org. We will take a break and be back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer book show. Not technically summer. It's getting hot, though, and we know you're planning your vacation to the beach or the mountains or wherever you go, and you're going to need some ideas for books. And so our local booksellers are back with us to give you plenty of titles and ideas. Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop, and Betsy's going to get us started.
Yeah, I'm going to start with a perfect book for the summer, The Hour of Land by Terry Tempest Williams, which I know we've talked about a great deal this week, but nonetheless, it is a perfect book for summer. One would think that a book on the national parks, which this is, would be a sort of glorious look at the national parks, which in part it is, but it's also...
She said she was going to start that way. She thought, that's what I thought I would do.
She did, but of course, knowing Terry,
yeah.
The truth wins over all. And the thing that's so brave about this book is that she uses every form. She's one of the bravest authors in this country, and she's unafraid to try anything to make it work. And so this goes everywhere, to every park, taking every form from letters to really poetry to just straightforward memoir, which we're used to natural history. And she draws together the history of this country. She goes back and she brings the history of the natural parks and the national parks together, but also really the history of this country. And one of my favorite parts of the book took place in Gettysburg, where she likens the way they portray the Civil War in the Deep South to the Sagebrush Rebellion here, and traces the roots of the sagebrush directly to there. I've never heard that before. It was a revelation to me. This whole book is a revelation. She is so brilliant. And it is a book that I think the New York Times said, read it, then turn it over and start again with a pencil. It's that kind of a book. But it is a beautiful book to read the first time. And it's not a hard book to read. It's fascinating. So for my summer really resolution is to go to at least 5 of these parks. It's not hard in Utah to do that.
No.
We have 5.
We do.
Exactly that, Betsy. You can
That's
do that.
Right. That's right. So I highly recommend that. Then
just say the name again.
The Hour of Land, right. A Personal Topography of America's National Parks by Terry Tempest Williams. Then a book that isn't quite out yet, but it's coming really soon, is The Latter Days, a memoir. It's by Judith Freeman. And again, I just adored this book. It's a memoir, and she's written about this. She grew up in Ogden. She's done memoir and fiction set here. But, you know, she grew up Mormon and then became disaffected, and she was bitter as a youth. She is not bitter in this book, and I have never read a better evocation of growing up where we grew up. She's exactly my age. She liked horses. She was a rebel. I thought, geez, I could have written this, except that she's a better writer than I could ever be. It just felt like I knew everything she was talking about. I grew up non-Mormon, so I had such trust in what she was saying, because she got it all so completely right, that I trusted everything she said about Mormonism, and it isn't negative at all. It's just fair-minded. Then very quickly...
Say the name of that, though, again.
Sorry.
I should mention that you might be familiar with her. She wrote the terrific book on... on the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
She did. And then she wrote the book on... the mystery writer, Raymond Chandler.
Raymond Chandler, yeah.
Yeah. She's a wonderful
place.
Writer.
Yeah, she really is.
And then very briefly, but perfect for summer, Far and Away by Andrew Solomon, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. He starts out as a kid hearing the story of the Holocaust, and he says to his dad, well, why didn't they run? And his dad said there was no place to go. So he became a traveler because he always had to have a place to go. And this goes around the world reporting on change in different cultures. It is wonderful to pick up and put down, wonderful to read all at once, a brilliant book.
He's very eloquent.
Oh, he's again, one of our very best writers.
Yeah, he really
Far and away, Andrew Solomon.
Great. Betsy, thanks. Ken Sanders.
I'm going to go in a completely different direction. My first pick is a new book called Rare Books Uncovered, True Stories of Fantastic Finds in Unlikely Places. The author is Rebecca Rego Berry. She is the editor of Fine and Rare Books magazine, almost only American magazines devoted to rare books for bibliophiles. So this is, if you like like John Dunning's Book to Die or Nicholas Bazbane's A Gentle Madness and his other bibliophile books. And Bazbane's, by the way, wrote the foreword to this book. You'll like this book. It features 52 different accounts of unlikely rare book finds, like a comic book collection from the 30s and 40s that was discovered. Kid had saved them all in perfect condition and they hadn't seen the light of day, including the first issue of Action Comics that features Superman that sells for millions and millions of dollars now. It was one of the best comic book finds. But I can't go into all the stories. There's 52 different ones. And in the shameless self-promotion department, one of the 52 is about me. I'm not going to go into the whole story. The title of it, not my title, but it's a good one, The 500-Year-Old Book Under the Bed. And basically, I volunteered doing appraisals at a little old museum in Sandy several years ago. And it was a snowy April day, and that's about all I'm going to say about it.
Good first line.
That's good. Hey, I have an idea. Talk to me after the show about this.
Okay, okay.
Wait, say the name of it again.
Rare Books Uncovered.
Yeah.
Rebecca Berry. I love Craig Johnson. He's the mystery guy. He's gotten quite famous with the first his HBO and now Netflix, his Longmire Detective.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget him coming here. I think maybe you brought him in, maybe for
he's
the library opening or something way back when. Mm-hmm. And I had a party for all the authors. And about 10:30 at night, and this guy, he's an ex-sheriff, you know, he's ex-cop.
He is, yeah.
He walks in total cop manner and pretends to be busting me and my party for doing something illegal. And he had me go. And I've been a fan of his ever since.
He's great.
So we got a great new Craig Johnson, Walt Longmire mystery thriller out, The Highwayman. I love it. And because it's summer, there's a reissue, Luli Lambrechti's, I can't pronounce his last name, Hiking the Escalante, that's updated. This is one of the first guidebooks that ever came out in Utah back in the 60s and early 70s. But this is a completely updated version that includes the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument, which should be National Park Number 6, duh, and the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area.
Say that name.
Hiking the Escalante. Yeah. It's a great new guidebook for people that like guidebooks, unlike me who like to wander around in the thorn bush and stumble around and get lots of scars on myself. Also, the great archaeological team, Jerry and Donna Spangler, who have done a bunch of books on Range Creek and the Tavaputs Plateau, have got a new one, a second one out now called Last Chance Highway on the history of Nine Mile Canyon. And it's a large, exhaustive, well-illustrated, and in their usual manner, just lots and lots of history that we just have never been made aware of. So those two, Hiking the Escalante and Last Chance Highway, are great new summer reads, in my opinion.
Yeah, which will inspire you to get out and wander around.
I just got back from 2 weeks.
Oh, good. Good.
I don't want to hear any more about that.
Cat.
All right. My book is But What If We're Wrong by Chuck Klosterman, which has the very alarming cover where everything is printed upside down. And every time I see it, I just have to turn it the other way. But this is an intriguing book. Chuck Klosterman is a pop culture guru in a lot of ways. In it, he conducts a series of thought experiments in which he wants to think about how we conceive of the future and why we, in whatever moment we're in, think that things will be this way forevermore. So he goes about trying to look at maybe some established scientific principles are wrong. Maybe some other things are wrong. And the passage I chose from this book, he starts talking about something, a scientific principle we all hold very dear and we feel that we see proven every single day.
This is a reading by the actress Fiona Hardingham.
Like most people, I like to think of myself as a skeptical person. But I'm pretty much in the tank for gravity. It's the force most recognized as perfunctorily central to everything we understand about everything else. If an otherwise well-executed argument contradicts the principles of gravity, the argument is inevitably altered to make sure that it does not. The fact that I'm not a physicist makes my adherence to gravity especially unyielding, since I don't know anything about gravity that wasn't told to me by someone else. My confidence in gravity is absolute, and I believe this will be true until the day I die. And if someone subsequently throws my dead body out of a window, I believe my corpse's rate of acceleration will be 9.8 meters per second squared. And I'm probably wrong. Maybe not completely, but partially. And maybe not today, but eventually. There is a very, very good chance that our understanding of gravity will not be the same in 500 years. In fact, that's the one arena where I would think that most of our contemporary evidence is circumstantial, and that the way we think about gravity will be very different.
So that last sentence or two about how there's a good chance gravity will be wrong, that is a quote from an interview that Klosterman did with Brian Greene. So the physicist Brian Greene is telling him that what we understand about gravity is probably wrong. Every section in this book does things likewise with the trademark Klosterman style, which Fiona Hardingham's lovely accent doesn't quite get that dry humor of his.
It was an interesting choice to have a British woman
read the book. Yeah, it certainly was. So he interviews and tangles with Neil deGrasse Tyson about some physics concepts. He talks with George Saunders and Junot Diaz about literature. Why do some books become famous? Why don't they? Every writer wonders that. It drove Melville to his grave, as a matter of fact. He talks with David Byrne about music when he's trying to think about what will be the band that is held up as the totem of rock and roll, since he believes rock and roll is fading now. He thinks it will be the Beatles at first, but then he posits, nope, it's going to be someone else.
Wow.
So it's an interesting, fun book full of ways to challenge yourself and hopefully the culture you're in. But What If We're Wrong by Chuck Klosterman.
Terrific. Okay, we're going to take a break, and then we'll get to some children's books, and we'll do a lightning round. We're doing well, you guys. Good job. Catherine Weller with the Weller Bookworks. We have Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. We'll take a break. And again, remember, all of these titles are on our website, radiowest.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabry. We're chatting here. We are, of course, with Ken Sanders and Betsy Burton and Catherine Weller, and we're talking books, giving you some titles, some suggestions as you go off. Great ones so far. And we're going to jump into some children's books now before we get to a lightning round. And Ken, why don't you get us started?
Well, as per usual, I'm going in a different direction. I've already been on a bibliophile kick today, so now I'm going to take that to bibliophile books for children. I'm not sure how big a category that is. This is something, I don't know, completely inappropriate that won't matter around here, but I love the book so much, I don't care. The Late Serendipity Books in Berkeley, California, Peter B. Howard was an extraordinary bookseller in every regard. And there's very few, I don't know if any bookstores ever had a children's book published about a single bookstore. It's called Rajanit Singhai's 9,000 Elephants Visit Serendipity Books. And you see the elephants are on a rampage in Berkeley. They've destroyed all the bookstores and they still got a lot of energy left. It's like, wow. So they see a bum on the street and he says, oh, no, there's a big bookstore just down this way and across the street. So they go, the elephants, all 9,000 of them, they go and kind of some scouts peer inside the store and they go, oh, no, somebody's been here before us and already wrecked the place. And they're because that Serendipity Books is usually in shambles.
Right.
And so, but then they said, oh, well, wait, there's a piece over there they didn't get. So they decide to go in and finish wrecking the place. And I can't do the whole book, but it goes on and on and on. They destroy the place. and they've left. The owner comes back. The owner comes back, and he stands there. Nancy, Carolyn, I've told you not to try and clean this place up in my absence. But look at all those empty shelves. You must have sold a lot of books. Good work. Anyhow,
dear to our heart.
It's just such a universal metaphor, and it's a crazy, crazy book. It's just the elephants are just rampaging through, and it's one of my favorite read alouds.
Say the title again.
I can't pronounce it, but
you did fine.
Rajat Singhai's 9,000 Elephants Visit Serendipity Books. One of my favorite children's books, and also in the retro phase. You've heard me talk a lot about my grandson Flynn on the show, but I also have a granddaughter, Lyra, and she's just 4 years old, so she can't quite read these yet, but I'm saving up a collection of Lois Lowry books for my granddaughter, Lyra, because I know when she does capable of reading them, she's going to love this series that stars this Anastasia Krupnik and all of these misadventures she has. And, you know, most boys don't grow up reading writers like Lois Lowry or Judy Blume or others. But now that I have a grandson and a granddaughter, I'm compiling Lyra a great library for the future as well. And I highly recommend, this Anastasia on her own, Anastasia at this address. It's a big, long, long series. And they're old, but they're wonderful books. Lastly, and Bachelor, a French artist that did this incredible modern interpretation of Alice. And I have a lot of other Alice books on the list because we're still in the 150th centennial year, 1866, of the first publication of the suppressed edition of Alice, which is going to be auctioned off very soon by a New York auction house. And its pre-sale estimate is $2 to $3 million. I predict that book will sell in the $4 to $5 million range. Mm-hmm. And Batchelor has now done a beautifully gorgeous illustrated edition of another legendary and American children's classic, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And her artwork is just so fresh and interpretive. It's just, I just absolutely love it. She's just not derivative of anyone.
Mm-hmm. Great. Catherine.
Right, I've been working with a lot of young voters this season, trying to make them young voters. And so I'm going to start with a book that's actually a little bit younger. This is probably upper elementary and junior high school. It's called The Art of the Possible, An Everyday Guide to Politics by Edward Keenan.
Wow.
This is such an intense political year, and people of all ages are interested in politics right now. So this is a great one. It starts with, so do you want to be a politician? And talking about what politicians are and what the art of politics is, goes into how you make strong arguments and try to convince people. Chapter 5, conflict is good. And then chapter 6, conflict can also be bad. And then talks about how people try to use different kinds of bad conflict to divide people. Then it ends with the power of the people, the power of the voice. It's really well done for children. It brings in examples of kids who've changed the world, ways the worlds have been changed. It's fantastic. It's The Art of the Possible by Edward Keenan. Then I have A Hungry Lion or a Dwindling Assortment of Animals by Lucy Ruth Cummins. And this is about a lion who goes to a birthday party and there are all of these animals who disappear one by one. And we wonder where they go. Lastly, I have the beautiful book Echo Echo by Marilyn Singer and illustrated by, Josie Mass. These are reverso poems about Greek myths, thus the Echo Echo. The illustrations are lovely and vibrant, and the poems just capture the myths so perfectly. In a reverso poem, a poem goes one way, and then they flip it around, so the last line of the previous poem becomes the first line of the next poem, and it replicates and still makes sense. It's beautiful. Echo Echo by Marilyn Singer.
Great.
Okay, with my theme of traveling around the country, Lady Liberty's Holiday, written by Jen Arena, illustrated by Matt Hunt, is about a very bored Lady Liberty who tells her pigeon friend that she has had it. She goes on the lam and sneaks away, visits all the the national parks that Terry talks about in a very different style, has a wonderful time and decides that she's probably never going home. She's in the Florida Keys with an alligator on her toe when the pigeon finds her and says, "You have got to come back. It's almost the 4th of July, and they're thinking of canceling it." And so she goes back to New York. Peace is restored. It's the perfect 4th of July book for children. Quite charming. Then a local author, Girl and Gorilla, Out and About. Rick Walton wrote this book. It's illustrated by Joe Berger, and it's a charming book about a young girl and a gorilla who want to go to the park. And they're riding along on the bicycle, and the bicycle crashes, and how are they going to get there? And they skip and hopscotch along, mourning the fact that they can't get there, and suddenly they're there. It's charming, but I wanted to say Rick Walton has written, I don't know, hundreds of children's books. He's so prolific. He is known to writers and teachers, and I think he's done more for writers in this community than anybody ever teaching at BYU. He is just beloved, and I wanted to acknowledge that.
Say the game again. Girl and...
Girl and Gorilla, and Rick Walton and Joe Berger. And then lastly, again, a local book, Hour of the Bees. This is the first novel, and it's quite brilliantly written, and it's about a family who... a teenage girl and her half-sister who have to leave for the summer because their grandfather, who they don't remember or barely remember, is a sheep rancher in New Mexico, and they have to put him in a home. And the story has some magical realism in it. It's about drought. It's about family, and it's really touching. It's called Hour of the Bees, and again, she's local, and boy, does she have a future.
I thought we'd have time for lightning round. We don't really much at all, in fact, because we're effectively out of time. But if you could pick one, Kat, what would you say?
Ladies of the Canyons by Leslie Poling Kemp.
Brian Evenson's new collection of short stories, A Collapse of Horses.
A Hero of France, a great summer read by Alan First. World War II mystery.
Love Alan First. Okay, great. Terrific. All right. Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. Kat Weller of Weller Bookworks, thank you all very much for being with us. And again, we will have a list of the stuff we got to and didn't on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program, technical direction today from Michael Havey. Tony Liu is our intern. Josh Weathers is producer of Video West, Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.